I wanted to talk about association, meaning the way in which people relate in groups. Because when you associate together in a group, it has a different effect than when you are working together, working alone. Now, there are many defects in group associations. We all know about that. We're all very aware of that. And we know about the difficulties that an individual can face when being restricted into the expectations of a group. However, there are also good things that come from this situation. There are good things which are available to us when we can have connection with people through group associations, or even if it is not in a formally created group. Now, people are social animals. They need to have connections with others. And as social animals, they are inclined towards doing things with others, towards assisting each other in ways which are valuable. Now, formerly, at least in the, I would say, the more, up until about maybe the 1800s or 1900s, early 1900s, the family, the community that you lived in or the village was performing that socially supportive activity and function. They were creating the situation by which if you needed help, there was somebody to help you. If you were sick, there was somebody to cook. If there was a group activity like bringing in the hay or cutting wood or something, they could all get together and do it. Neighbors and family can come together and assist each other. Now, in certain circumstances, there were other kinds of groups and associations of people, religious associations, the church or the temples performed enormously important social functions as well as religious functions. If you remember, whenever there was a religious gathering or a spiritual gathering on a certain important day, people would come together, but what would they mainly? They would mainly be speaking with each other, how are you doing? Oh, I haven't seen you in a long time. The whole day is spent in greeting others in a social environment. Even today, most churches or religious organizations have an enormous emphasis on social interaction and contact through bingo, this game they play, or sales of things, or charity works where they try to raise some money in a charity drive to help some people somewhere, or they have groups which support others who need that. Then there are also situations like Alcoholics Anonymous, or groups which get together. And we're now in the present day, groups which get together and support each other trying to overcome their alcoholic problem. There are also sexaholic groups where people who are just overly attached and addicted to sex get together and try to stabilize their ability to associate with others in relationships. There are groups for pregnant mothers. There are groups for mothers with children. There are groups for people who are dealing with others in their family who are alcoholics. There are groups who deal with drug addiction. There are groups who get together and support each other when there were cancer or deaths in the family. There are all kinds of groups out there right now. There are groups also of the mystical variety where they are performing all kinds of mystical activities together or learning how to do so, or they're doing some kind of rites together. There are pagan groups where they worship all kinds of the forms of nature and make things happen. There are groups all over the world where people get together with others who have a similar intention and they support each other. Now, when people join groups, they are not fully aware of what they are joining, because they don't know everything about the group. They're just joining. They know they have some idea of some of the ideals of a group, and it attracts them. So they get into it. They have some idea of some of the people. Initially, they are attracted. They get into it. And they also gradually start to accept the ideals of a group because they get into it. They're starting to specialize themselves in the understanding and the characteristics of a particular group and making relationships with the people in it who have a certain way of thinking. And sometimes they accept membership in the group, and they sometimes accept initiations into a group, and in this way they become part of a group. Now, we can understand that in many situations, this social support, this social association, is worth more than what one gets out of a group in terms of the specific situation of the philosophies or the ideologies or whatever. It's just like my situation right here. Here I am sitting alone, and I have to do something. But it's actually a two-man job or more. So these associations where you can do things together with others, they're very beneficial. I mean, in many ways, we are benefited by having others to do things together with. And not only that, but we support each other emotionally and psychologically. Just if you know there are people there or somebody you can talk to or something that you can do with others sometimes, it's really helpful. It's very enlivening. Now the question becomes, which kind of a group, which kind of an association? Last week we spoke about the association for a peaceful ether, you know, where we would work together to somehow or another create a peaceful and very pure environment in the world. Well, that was 2 weeks ago. No, last week. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been experiencing, whenever I have connected to our association and worked in my own way to help purify the ether, that actually there's a very strong connection there. There's a strong ring of people in the etheric platform around the world. There's a strong connection there because we share energetically the desire to do something similar. It's not like we're going to get out of this something selfish. We're all very joined together in a very unselfish way to do something quite beneficial for others. Now, when you work that way without expecting something from someone else in an exploitative kind of way, it makes a very strong bond. But when you connect to others with the idea or expectation to exploit them, to in somehow or another be selfish and take something from them, the bond that is created is very weak. It's dependent on your own self-interest. And that which is depending on self-interest creates, I would say, the seeds of destruction of the relationship, because there'll always be one who gains and one who loses in such a relationship. Relationships have to be win-win, which means you gain, I gain, everyone gains in our contribution in the relationship. Even if it's difficult, even if it's a work, but still there is this idea of progressive gain, of the increase of prosperity, and I don't just mean it financially, it can also mean energetic prosperity. There is the idea of growth. There is the idea of advancement. There is the idea of doing something valuable, of doing something significant for others, which feeds us, which is like a fertilizer on the soul. Every kind of a growing organism needs some kind of nourishment. And for plants, they need fertilizer, or they need nutrients. We all need nutrients. For the soul, for the energy, we need the nutrient of having our energy do something good, do something significant for the sake of others, which feeds us enormously. It doesn't feed the soul to be working selfishly, to being simply interested in one's own interest at the sake of others by exploiting them. It doesn't feed the soul, it doesn't nourish it. It may feed the body, it may feed the mind, but it doesn't feed the soul. What is amazing is it doesn't even feed the heart. You know, if let's say you have a relationship with somebody, intimate relationship, between man and woman or something like that. So if you come close to them, even you manage to get them to think that you have a close relationship, yet you are interested in taking from them, you may be satisfied physically or mentally, or maybe even economically, but your heart does not feel nourished by that. Now, you may have this idea of that you wish to get pacified in a relationship. Like, for example, let's say I have a headache and I take an aspirin or some kind of painkiller. It will cure the headache, but it will not nourish me. It is not like a vitamin or a mineral. It doesn't nourish me. It just takes away a pain. And that which takes away a pain is not necessarily something which is overall very good for me. I mean, after all, pain and nourishing are two different things. And when you think about it in a relationship with another person, if somebody gives you love, if somebody gives you satisfaction, it may pacify your pain, but it doesn't nourish you unless you accept them and offer to them your loving energy, which is accepted in a reciprocating, growing, evolutionary relationship. And I think this point is an essential point in associations, which is very important, where an association of people should consider how to nourish each other in relationship to their soul growth, rather than pacify their needs, which is a selfish ideal. There's a big difference between the two. And I think this difference is often misunderstood. The soul is a sensitive thing. And that's what sometimes people forget, that the soul of everybody is sensitive. There are many people who perform activities and actions which are judged as abominable by others, yet their soul, their essence, is sensitive. It is not being nourished. It is feeling pain. It is not growing. Now, it is not always possible to help everybody in such an advanced situation of dysfunction. But in associations where we are trying to grow together, we should consider the sensitivity of the soul and direct our activities towards nourishing that in a sensitive way, which is compatible with growth. So our esoteric association has some benefit in the sense that this activity of doing something for the sake of others, which was so attractive to all who are in spiritual movements, can be again utilized, but without the negative aspects of it. However, it is also possible that etheric associations can have exploitation, can have selfish considerations, which create the same difficulties that are there in other associations. This can come when people take energy from others. For example, one becomes an energy sucker, feeding off of the energy of others, because one is oneself weak. Now, if there are enough people involved, and there's enough power in the group, then such persons can be nourished or be pacified and can start to grow on their own and develop their own power. Kind of like when you start a wheel going which has been slowed down. It can also start to go on its own for a while. Sometimes I feel in the morning very tired. I don't feel very active. If I do a little bit of exercise, get the blood moving, then it jump starts me on the day. So it doesn't work. You know, the blood's not moving. Things are not functioning. So you jumpstart a little bit. You get a little bit of help. With that little bit of help, your own internal energetic metabolistic system starts to function. And sometimes in a group situation, it is the same, that people who are a little weak need to be jump-started so they can get into things. So supporting them is also part of the service of such a group. But when that number becomes too great and the support is too much, then things become very difficult. And therefore, it is also important to burn up the negativity. Because a lot of people need support simply because they're overwhelmed by negative energy. Just like when you're growing a plant, you want to keep away the negative influences. Like if it becomes too dry, or it becomes with bugs, or it's not cut properly. You've got to somehow or another nourish it in such a way that it will not be overwhelmed by negative influences, and you nourish it enough so that its natural growth will grow when it's strong and it can overcome a lot of obstacles. So this association that we have is like a nourishing organization. It's meant to nourish. If it doesn't nourish, then it has no value. The overall goal is not more important than the nourishment of those who are involved. Let's say, for example, we have a wonderful group which burns up all the negativity everywhere, but we have not been able to nourish each other. We start to develop this exploitation of the other's energy, or try to use others in our own particular way, or control them with our capacities and powers. This has no value. You may save the world, but if you can't save yourself or the person next to you, what is the use? Doing anything good in this world is a person-to-person, step-by-step process. It's something which is done from me to the next person, me to the next person. That next person to the next person. It's something which expands outward from each of us. It's not something that comes from above down. When we connect to the divine beings or divine energy above, when we connect in this etheric association and burn up the negativity, what we are really doing is supporting each and every one of us to such a degree that we can manifest change as an individual right here, right now. And if it was so that beings on the higher levels could enact change, if that's what we feel right now, that we are just connecting, they will enact change, then they can do it without us. They don't need us to enact the change. They will just simply enact the change, bring it down to us, and then we will just enjoy the transformation. But it's not the way it works. Nobody can create a situation by which another is transformed. We can only create a situation where we can support and assist another person to transform. And these most disturbing situations in the world are not generally created by single individuals. They're created by groups of individuals. So these groups of individuals who may do, let's say, for example, an act of harm against someone else, or an act of exploitation of war against someone else, you cannot even influence them directly. You have to influence the individuals. One has to win each and every person with giving them something relevant and valid in their own life. This is a very huge work. And that's what we are learning to do in association with these divine beings, is to support ourselves, to nourish ourselves so that we can give support and nourishment to others in very practical ways in the form of associations. And it may not even be possible to do it in large scale. It may not be possible in a large scale to do such a thing. But it is possible to do it on an individual by individual basis, which is, after all, a very great service. If you think about it, this is the way angels work. They work on an individual person-by-person basis. They just try to do something good for somebody. One doesn't have to build up a huge organization with big buildings and big income and big activities. One basically has to make an impact on an individual. Now, if these things help to make those impacts on the individual, fine. But it's very hard to combine both the development of an institution and the nurturing of individuals. It's very difficult. If you look at Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya, the Goswamis, all those kind of very wonderful souls, they influenced enormous amounts of individuals on a one-by-one basis. They didn't even have mass publications in those days. It was a one-by-one basis. And they did the most significant influencing of individuals. Nowadays, you have organizations which can print billions and huge amounts of books and publications of all kinds, media of all kinds, huge buildings with ceremonies and so on. Yet, this does not necessarily impact the individual. It may just be, in many cases, that you get a dysfunctional individual accepting a covering of functionality by acting within the expectations of this larger organization. So therefore, we always have the situation, the possible situation, the potential of the situation, where you make so much effort and endeavor in the name of spirituality or in the name of associations that in the name of doing good for others are basically just reproducing the same situation as you already have outside in what was called the material, quote-unquote, realm, and doesn't really perform the function that is commensurate to all that work. So in other words, people replace building their own empire for building the empire of some group. So you end up with a very interesting dichotomy, a very interesting difficulty, whereby one seriously and idealistically wants to nourish, yet in the name of getting to the point of nourishing, one ends up with this very, shall we say, impossible situation of again being entangled in a development which does not nourish at all. So, I feel that there are many situations which seem to be accepted as the standard in people's minds, all religionists, all spiritualist minds, as to what is the right thing to do. Yet it seems that in many cases, now of course I can't generalize to everybody and all, but in many cases, it just does not work. Let's take, for example, all of the nice aspects of Krishna consciousness, like chanting, good prasadam, eating together, nice deities, a good discussion about the very those aspects of this very esoteric mystical philosophy. These things have value. And when you, as an individual, share that with others, simply help to nourish them by giving them the tools in that particular system, then that has an impact on them. It has a benefit to them. Formerly in the olden times, what you really had was some brahmanas or some gurus or some swamis or some people just nourishing individuals like this in an individual way. It was not a big, organized, institutionalized thing. You can nourish people one by one as you are without using, for example, Krishna conscious terminology or things, simply by sharing your strength, your internal strength, your internal nourishment with others. And when you share like this, what happens is that you're actually giving the essence of what spirituality is all about. That you have been nourished, you wish to nourish. It's like you have that realization of what it means to be nourished. And therefore, you can give that actual nourishment to others. Not that you have to hear what is nourishment or to accept what it means to be nourished from others because you've heard it, or it was supposed to be like that, or it's the authorized way. But rather, you have been nourished in whatever way you have, to whatever degree you have, and you feel the loving desire to assist in that way. You know, there are many times we've heard that the most important time of life is the transition towards death. What counts is what you think about at the moment of death. Of course, that is misunderstood. But we've heard that a lot. Yet, how much emphasis do we place on being there for somebody in such a situation? Yet there are people in the world who've dedicated their lives to helping older people make this transition by making them comfortable or making them feel somehow or another secure because they've been rejected by their families or they have no friends. Such people give to whatever degree they know how to nourish from the soul level. They help these people move on to their next destinations. Similarly, there are people who use their capacity to nourish children who have been rejected or neglected in this world, to help them grow, to help them find themselves, even though they're filled with bitterness or filled with feelings of just detachment or hatred towards the world for putting them in this parentless or penniless situation. Now, I know that certain institutions say this is all Maya, and certain churches try to help people in this way, and other people don't even think about such things. I'm just simply giving these as examples that you don't have to be a big, big, great, great in order to help, assist, or nurture other people, and that this individual-to-individual way in which we can share what we have with others is that which gives us meaning in life. And after all, whether we admit it or not, searching for meaning is that which we are constantly engaged in. Constantly. Even when we are engaged in just daily, day-to-day maintenance activities, we always have in our mind, what's the point? What's the point of this? Or I would say better, we have in our mind the idea that it should have a meaning. Sometimes we forget the meaning. Sometimes we just act at busy work or we just get involved intensely with some activity like this. We forget the point of what we're doing. At that point, we get panic or we get disgusted or we get discouraged. But in the back of the mind, which means somewhere above the heart, there's always this nagging doubt. I'm doing this for a reason, yet I don't find contact or connection to that reason. For example, in a marriage where you get together because you want to feel the connection of love, you want to feel the nourishment of having an intimate, stable, and very, very deep connection with another person. But instead of feeling that all the time, one becomes absorbed in activities like buying this and cleaning that and throwing out this and doing that and making money here and changing things there. One is just busy all the time. One is making a busy way of life. And sometimes people drift away because of this. They drift away from each other because their busyness has sent them into different realms. And then they stop and they turn and they look and they say, but where's the intimacy? Where's the connection? And one may say to the other, you don't love me, you don't care about me, blah, blah, blah. They make these excuses and they try to find it in someone else because that's what they're looking for. So those who are aware, they keep this idea in the forefront. We are in this relationship for this intimacy of connection. And by the way, we share practical things. Similarly, in an esoteric associations, we are in this to help create peace, purification in the etheric framework of the world, to support, to nourish. So it's a question of feeling always the priority, of understanding and keeping in mind why I'm doing something, why I'm engaged as a person in a particular way. I'll tell you as an example how I feel sometimes when our technology breaks down here. I have been researching what we are doing constantly this whole week, and there's nobody in the world who's doing what we're doing. There are others who do something kind of similar, but that's in corporations where they're spending $1,000 a month and having subscriptions and private broadcasts. Everything we're doing here is experimental. We're doing it with internet connections intercontinentally, which are lousy anyway in Russia, for instance. And we have these horrible problems that we have to deal with all the time, and it breaks down right in the middle of while I'm doing it. For example, right now, the whole server And Tampa's totally down. It doesn't work at all. And while I'm talking, you know, this thing goes down, that thing goes down, this is broken, that's broken. I get very discouraged. I say, hey, I can't do this anymore. I can't think. I can't do anything. I'm totally absorbed in fixing things and sending messages. And when I send a message and I type, you can't hear Mahashaya anymore because of the bad way the echo cancellation is arranged. And then I feel, forget the whole thing. I can't take this. I can't take this contradiction between trying to give what I can from my heart for nursing and fight with this technology at the same time. I say, forget it. And then I say, wait a minute. What am I doing here? The whole point is to give what you can give. The whole point is to nourish as you can. Just forget about this technological junk. Just drop it. Whatever it is, it is. Whatever you can give, you can give. Whoever can listen, can listen. That's all there is to it. And then I become focused again. I can speak again. I can feel again what I'm supposed to do. And then it works again. Then it works again. It gives me power again to do what I have to do. I find that in personal relationships too, when you get just so much absorbed in practicality or you get so much absorbed in difficulties, you forget the point of the whole thing. Then you have to stop and say, wait, that's not what I signed on to here. That's not the point here. And then you again connect on that relationship of love. You just say, forget all this. I love you. That's all. Have you ever noticed that all this difficulty, this friction, this problem, blah, 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 disappears when you're lying on your deathbed? Now you have no strength. Now you have no capacity. Now you have no possibility whatsoever to be involved in these political or disturbing affairs of the world. All you've got is your love. That's all you've got. And you love to give it. And you love it when others accept it. A little baby, that's all a little baby has. That's what we in the beginning, we're like babies. And dying, when we're dying, we're very similar. We wear diapers. Other people feed us. They take care of us. In both stages. Older people, when they're in the last stages, they wear diapers. Other people feed them. Other people take care of them. It's just like being a baby. So your life is like a sandwich. You're born with love. You die with the love. And in between, you're just a bunch of activities where you forget all about love. Obviously, that's an extreme analogy, but there's a certain truth to it, that we become so absorbed in the practicality of our lives that we forget what's the point of our lives. And yet these experiences we have within practicality, these experiences we have as we try to live out our dreams, are also very valuable. And yet when we're dying and we're back at that defenseless, helpless situation of love, we understand the real point of it all. So what I've been trying to say here is that these associations where we offer ourselves as nourishers, where we accept nourishment, where we exchange and reciprocate on the platform of nourishment, which means loving, supportive, and purifying exchanges, this should be kept in the forefront even when we are engaged in various practical activities. Because then we will always have contact with the meaning and purpose of our lives. We develop this idea of meaningless, we develop this idea of purposefulness when we don't have contact with giving and nourishing others. And again, this is not a quantitative thing. It's not like you have to make some kind of organization to do it in a monstrous way. It's a one-to-one, person-to-person activity. It starts with yourself. It starts with nourishing yourself. It then moves to your family, and then to your friends and your community or anybody you happen to meet. And this gives purpose to your life and meaning when you can see in little ways how you have done something significant for others. And I suppose this is the whole point of associations. And if you keep that the point, and maintain that very clear and purposeful meaning to the life, then things can really clarify in yourself, clarify when others look at you and consider what you are, and also how you fit within the energy field in this world. I have a couple of questions here. I'll take the first question is, who has created the EAP that I spoke about or wrote about? Could it have been known under some other names in the past? Does it have any relation with Shambhala's White Brotherhood or Ashtar's company? I don't know, Ashtar. So, who has created it? Well, I don't really know. I think this has been created long ago, and it has many personalities involved all over the place, and it's not recent, that's for sure, and I can't say it was a single person. I have no idea. Sorry. I know that I have been aware of it since the early 80s, but I was not told to do anything about it until just recently. Because it seems that just recently it is time to actually do something about it and to actually make this work in a broader way, or at least the part of it that I'm involved in. And as I have mentioned before, that definitely it has been known under other names. There are others who have been dealing with it, perhaps parts of it, not all of it. Everybody or all of those who have had connection may have not had a complete connection, and maybe we don't have a complete connection now. But it definitely has been manifested in other places throughout the world. People have been talking about it, perhaps parts of it. It probably has some connection with the White Brotherhood. I think that's probably quite true. I don't know if it does about Ashtar's company in the same sense. But those who are giving information from above, who are helping from above, they are somehow or another connected. Maybe at one point I can give more information. It can be explained like this. Just as we can extend our hand and connect with others around the world, even without knowing who they are or where they are, similarly, on that other level, even though there are beings who are on many different levels and have many different capacities, they are connecting in the same way. In fact, when we do our connections like this, even what we think is on this world, we are connecting to beings in other dimensional realms. Dimensional, the word used very loosely, very other dimensional realms, and we are making connections practically throughout the ether. It doesn't matter where physically these beings are. And this is all because there is a similarity of energy amongst all of us. So connecting to any particular being anywhere is theoretically not a difficulty to do. So this association is indeed a universal association, but when I was writing, although I was kind of encouraged to put universal, I was afraid to do so because it seemed a little bit pompous, and I didn't want to write in a pompous way. And naturally, these connections have value. Naturally, these connections have meaning, because when you feel from heart to heart, there is always compassion. There is always the desire to be of service. I hope that I have given a little bit more insight into this. If you want to know more, and if I'm capable of answering more, you can write. And here I have a question which I'm not exactly sure. It says, there's a difficulty, it seems, to define the differences between, how to define in general, Supreme Self and Divine Self. And how are these terms correlated to Vedic definition? Well, I think the problem arises when you speak about self. that is the term which makes things difficulty, not the difference between supreme or divine. That which is divine is part of the supreme, there is no doubt about it. The supreme is also divine. We are also divine. We may not manifest it, but all beings are inherently divine. But none of us would accept the terminology as supreme. We are all part of the supreme, sure. We all feel like that. And we are all divine parts, but none of us would accept the terminology as ourselves being the supreme. So that kind of gives a definition of a difference between divine and supreme. Now we can try to deal with self. Now, the terminology of self, well, that kind of gives us a difficulty to deal with. Because when you speak about self, the self means what? It means the spirit soul. What is the spirit soul? It is in a categorical way, because self is also a categorical thing. It's a category. It's a little part of the spiritual whole, the spiritual complete divine energy. But if you're talking about self and you want to place it specifically on an individual, like me or you, well then, again, the same definition would be there. There's the supreme self, which means the self that is the supreme, or God. And then there's the selves which are divine, which are us. God is also one of them. So that becomes an easy way to describe those two terms. But the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's another way you can speak about self, the self. When we use the term, there is only one of us, when we speak about there's only one of us, we enter into the situation where we are the self, in the sense of as a group, as another entity that is complete and whole within itself, yet has all these cellular parts of consciousness. So that makes the definition a little bit more difficult. So I wonder if this helped in that explanation. At least that's, I think, the best I can do with that question. Now I have other questions. I'm being asked, what is the meaning of the coming of God on this planet? Interesting question. Not something that we have thought about in a while. Now, when the Supreme manifests, the Supreme is manifesting a part of the Supreme's energy for a specific purpose. So, in that way, we see that the Supreme also has interest in nurturing, in supporting, and being part of the gardening process by which all of us can develop, pulling weeds, taking out that which is of a vastly negative energy, and at the same time offering support and nourishment by caring for all of the beings that are here. So we find that the Supreme performs that service, of the same exact service that I was speaking about, that we should perform. It's just that we are reflecting the intention of the Supreme when the Supreme enters into this realm to be of service, that we can also reflect that and be of the same kind of a service in our own little way. There is, in other words, not that much of a difference in the motivation between the Supreme's coming here or going anywhere and our doing it. The only difference is that the Supreme is ever aware of that purpose, whereas we become distracted by other forms of opportunities here on this planet. We're not so focused. We're not so aware of ourselves. We're not so conscious at every moment of our mission, so to speak, whereas the Supreme is. Now, that may sound a little unusual for people who are not ready for such an answer. Yet if you think about it, when you are feeling very sincerely the desire to nurture others, when you are feeling very sincerely the desire to love and serve, to be of service, you are reflecting exactly the same motivation of the Supreme. At least that's the way I would reply to that question. Sometimes people say the Supreme has come for the enjoyment of the Supreme. Well, we share that same. Again, it's a question of the quantity or the particular pure quality of that enjoyment that may be different. And then there's another question here which is quite interesting, and I'm not sure I can properly answer it, but I'll try anyway because it's been asked. Now, this question is based on an assumption, and I am not sure that the assumption is correct. In fact, I would question the assumption. So I will first read the assumption. Now, go ahead. Now, the question is that it assumes if we are choosing our lives, that means we are choosing the particular sufferings that we experience. That's the assumption of this question. And then the question is, well, what about the animals? Because animals are not choosing their particular sufferings and why they have to suffer anyway. Now, sure, on the surface it sounds right, but I think the problem with this question is that we don't choose our sufferings. We may choose our situations. We may choose our potential opportunities for our evolution. We may not specifically choose our sufferings. We may choose the challenges we face in terms of what opportunities we're offered, or what country we're born in, or what economic situation, or what physical body, or what parents. But we may not choose, for instance, to have lousy teeth, or to have to see bad dentists, or to lose money at the stock market. So, in other words, we establish together, not necessarily totally out of our own free will, but we establish together with our guides or with those who are helping us to create a new lifetime, the opportunities, the situations, the circumstances within which we will evolve, not the individual details of our suffering. Now, that's very different than, for example, the animals, who probably are not engaged in a conscious creation of their opportunities or potentials. But what it does show is that anybody who comes into this particular world has to take with it all of the external situations which create pleasure and pain. Don't make the mistake of thinking that your entrance into this world is totally under control. You write the whole script and that's exactly the way it goes. No, there are unlimited amounts of influences all around us that are constantly inputting into our lives and transforming it in different ways. Yet the basic influences, the basic themes of our lives, even you could see it in an astrological chart, these themes have been settled at the moment of birth because this is the way we have decided to enter into this world. And the particular sufferings that we have to go through within this journey, whether it be us or animals or anybody, are there simply because we're interacting with matter. We're interacting with situations which create pain. It's just the way it is. It's not like it has some huge purpose to it, except that it encourages us to try to transcend this creation. Let's say I go out and I clean the backyard and I'm picking up bush. Sometimes there are thorns. The thorns catch me. They make cuts. You see? Cuts. Nothing much you can do about it. You know, here they are, these little cuts that come from working in the garden, right? So it's not like I said, okay, before I joined this world, in this body, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, at this point, go out and pick up some bushes and get a cut and suffer. It's just that, okay, you've got this opportunity to live, yet some plants have thorns and sometimes you step on a rock because rocks are there, thorns are there. not because you created it. If you choose to walk into a smoke-filled room, you're going to breathe smoke. It's the choice of entering into a certain situation that brings you a result. But it is not that you may have thought before you made the choice that I'm going to walk into this room and there's going to be all that smoke. You may not have known anything about it. It may just have been there. You made the choice to walk into the room. You may not have any notice whatsoever that there was other persons making the choice to smoke there. So I don't think that one should start to analyze the suffering of a particular painful situation that we run into and generalize it to the choices that we make as evolved beings in the evolution of our lives. In other words, there are differences in the levels of consciousness. And at one point in your level of evolutionary consciousness, you become an active participant in your evolution, whereas in other points of your evolutionary consciousness, before that development takes place, you are a passive participant. Let's take the example here of some ants. There are ants walking around. And yet at the same time, there are ant eaters walking around. There are beings that eat ants. So it's not like the ants chose to be where there are ant eaters. It's just that there are ants over here. There's ant eaters over there. The ant eaters walk by and say, oh, ants, yummy, and eat them. There is a lot of interaction on a cosmic level, and don't expect that I'm going to be able to explain why all of these arrangements are there. Why an ant takes birth there where there's an anteater, another takes birth in a forest where there's never any disturbance. It's way beyond me. It's just you're talking about billions of living entities in billions of situations. It is so complex. I would just say in general that, you know, things are arranged according to rules and laws of practical organization that are way over my head. And some people like to put it all on the shoulders of karma, that there is this burden of suffering that has to take place. And therefore, everybody is, it's being shared from whatever reason, and therefore it's going on. Well, you can say like that. If it makes you feel that you've got a good answer and it satisfies you, go right ahead. I mean, I can't justify it or verify it in any way, and you can either believe it or not believe it. I don't think that everything can be explained. I don't think that there are answers for everything. And I don't think that, I know people want to see why. Why is the creation there? That's a very big cosmic question. That's an easier question to answer, but to see the specifics of it and how it all fits together, you know, just start to understand how it is that a rose is created. I mean, it's beyond our understanding, or this specific curve that follows this particular sequence, mathematical sequence that is reproducing throughout nature. I mean, how do you explain that? These are just creations of an intelligence and an arrangement that's so far beyond us. I mean, hey, I know there's a reason for it. Don't ask me, though, what is the reason. Don't ask me for the reason. I mean, I'm flattered that you would think I could answer such a question. But to be quite honest, I haven't the faintest idea in the world. I mean, outside of this very simplistic and easy answer of karma from previous creations, of why one ant is born there and one ant is born there. I mean, honestly speaking, I have enough problems just trying to wake up in the morning to figure that out. I can't figure that out. And I would say that if you can figure it out, share it with me. I'd be fascinated how you got to that. I mean, honestly, that's really something to discuss, but don't ask questions. I can't answer that question. I mean, it's kind of funny, you know, that it's like, hey, it's fun to talk about, sure, but way over my head. Okay, back to the question that originally was there between divine self and supreme self. As I thought in the beginning, it's a problem with the translation. I'll just read to you what it says, what the question here. We found a discrepancy here. The problem of translation, which is when we speak in Russian of our higher being, we use the word combination which can sound as supreme self, and it corresponds to our own higher or divine inner self. And when we speak of the Lord within, we say in Russian something which may sound in English as divine self. Yeah, okay, but what was the question then? So, Mahashaya, you've got to explain it to me. When you're trying to say in Russian the higher being in, of yourself, of your own higher being, or when you try to speak about the Lord within you in Russian, can you explain it better? So basically I answered it before, but in a different way.